Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. There are no death notices in today's Arizona Republic, so we're going to go straight to the business section. And top of the page, Robinhood launches tokens for EU users. The move allows them to trade in U.S. stocks. Robinhood said on June 30th that it has launched tokens that will allow its customers in the European Union to trade more than 200 U.S. stocks and exchange-traded funds, including Nvidia, Apple, and Microsoft. Commission-free tokens can be traded around the clock, 5 days a week. Robinhood also plans to offer tokens linked to stocks of privately held companies, starting with Sam Altman's OpenAI and Elon Musk's SpaceX, the trading platform's top executive said at its keynote event in France. The tokens will be issued through a partnership with blockchain firm Arbitrum. With the move, the company stands to benefit from rising global interest in the U.S. stock market, home to some of the world's most influential tech giants and leading beneficiaries of the AI boom. Tokenized equities mix traditional finance with crypto-like trading and have been gaining traction among international investors due to better access, flexible trading hours, and lower costs. Experts believe such tokens could dramatically alter the securities investment landscape, though they currently lack regulatory clarity in the United States. Menlo Park, California-based Robinhood plans to eventually develop its own blockchain that will expand trading hours for tokens to 7 days a week. The company will also expand the number of available stock tokens to thousands by the end of the year, Tednev said at the event. Tokenization is going to open the door to massive trading revolution, he said. Crypto exchange Kraken also launched equities-linked tokens for non-U.S. investors in May. Robinhood also announced several new product offerings, including crypto perpetual futures for its EU customers and staking for U.S. users. The perpetual futures will allow users to make leveraged bets on the prices of cryptocurrencies. Unlike traditional futures, they have no expiration date. Rival Coinbase will also begin offering similar tools to U.S. customers. And the next headline in this section, immigration raids leave many crops unharvested. California farms and food supply chain is at risk. Lisa Tate is a sixth-generation farmer in Ventura County, California, an area that produces billions of dollars worth of fruit and vegetables each year, much of it hand-picked by immigrants in the U.S. illegally. Tate knows the farms around her well, and she says she can see with her own eyes how raids carried out in June by agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the area's fields, part of President Donald Trump's migration crackdown, have frightened off workers. In the fields, I would say 70% of the workers are gone, she said. If 70% of your workforce doesn't show up, 70% of your crop doesn't get picked and can go bad in one day. Most Americans don't want to do this work. Most farmers here are barely breaking even. I fear this has created a tipping point where many will go bust. In the vast agricultural lands north of Los Angeles, stretching from Ventura County into the state's Central Valley, two farmers, two field supervisors, and four immigrant farm workers told Reuters that the ICE raids have led a majority of workers to stop showing up. That means crops are not being picked and fruit and vegetables are rotting at peak harvest time, they said. One Mexican farm supervisor, who asked not to be named, was recently overseeing a field being prepared for planting strawberries. Usually he would have 300 workers, he said. On that day, he had just 80. Another supervisor at a different farm said he usually has 80 workers in a field, but just 17 that day. Most economists and politicians acknowledge that many of America's agricultural workers are in the country illegally, but say a sharp reduction in their numbers could have devastating impacts on the food supply chain and farm belt communities. Douglas Holtz Eakin, a Republican and former director of the Congressional Budget Office, said an estimated 80% of farm workers in the United States were foreign-born, with nearly half of them in the country illegally. Losing them will cause price hikes for consumers, he said. This is bad for supply chains, bad for the agricultural industry, Holtz-Eatkin said. Over a third of U.S. vegetables and over three-quarters of the country's fruits and nuts are grown in California, according to the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The state's farms and ranches generated nearly $60 billion in agricultural sales in 2023. Of the four immigrant farm workers Reuters spoke to, two are in the country illegally. Though these two spoke on the condition of anonymity, out of fear of being arrested by ICE. One, age 54, has worked in U.S. agriculture fields for 30 years and has a wife and children in the country. He said most of his colleagues have stopped showing up for work. If they show up for work, they don't know if they'll ever see their family again, he said. The other worker in the country illegally told Reuters, basically, we wake up in the morning scared. We worry about the sun, the heat, and now a much bigger problem, many not returning home. I try not to get into trouble on the street. Now whoever gets arrested for any reason gets deported. To be sure, some farm workers' community groups said many workers were still returning to the fields, despite the raids, out of economic necessity. The days following a raid may see decreased attendance in the field, but the workers soon return because they have no other sources of income, five groups told Reuters. Workers are taking other steps to reduce their exposure to immigration agents, like carpooling with people with legal status to work, or sending U.S. citizen children to the grocery store, the group said. Trump conceded in a post on his Truth Social account in June that ICE raids on farm workers, and also hotel workers, were taking very good, long-time workers away from those sectors, with those jobs being almost impossible to replace. Trump later told reporters, our farmers are being hurt badly. They have very good workers, he added, but they're not citizens, but they've turned out to be great. He pledged to issue an order to address the impact, but no policy change has yet been enacted. Trump has always stood up for the farmers, said White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly, in response to a request for comment on the impact of the ICE raids to farms. He will continue to strengthen our agricultural industry and boost exports while keeping his promise to enforce our immigration laws, she said. Bernard Yaros, lead U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, a nonpartisan global economics advisory firm, said in a recent report published on June 26th that native-born workers tend not to fill the void left by immigrant workers who have left. Unauthorized immigrants tend to work in different occupations than those who are native-born, he said. ICE operations in California's farmland were scaring even those who are authorized, said Greg Tesh, who runs a farm in Central California. Nobody feels safe when they hear the word ICE, even the documented people. We know that the neighborhood is full of a combination of those with and without documents, Tesh said, and we need the labor. And continuing with the business section of today's Arizona Republic, Disney policy hits commercial timeshare renters. Change puzzles some vacation club members. Disney Vacation Club recently updated its policy to crack down on commercial rentals, but some say it's leaving some members confused. DVC, Disney's version of a timeshare, added a new condition to its membership terms and conditions in early June, requiring people to certify their booking is, quote, solely for personal use and not for commercial purposes, end quote, by clicking a checkbox, according to Disney Tourist Blog. It goes on to define personal use as enjoying the benefits of a DVC membership with family or allowing use of any vacation home to friends and family on occasion. This policy of prohibiting commercial use has been longstanding and is now reflected by the new adjustment, according to Disney. The move is intended to curb large-scale renters who exploit the system for profit. However, some believe the language is too murky for the average member to navigate and doesn't effectively reduce commercial renters. It's creating heartburn for average everyday members who want to follow the rules, said Chad Pennycuff, a DVC member since 2017 and host of the My DVC Points podcast. Commercial renting has proliferated online, with some fringe members consistently having up to 30 key reservations during peak travel times, such as the winter holidays, according to Penny Cuff. The internet and social media changed all that. People share on Facebook groups to rent out points. Some members have complained that they can't find availability during this time, leading to DVC implementing the new requirement. Tom Bricker of Disney Tourist Blog told USA Today in an email that he believes DVC's visible policy change is placating members who have complained about the proliferation of commercial renters, decreasing demand for rentals by introducing an element of risk and uncertainty, and scaring some of the large commercial renters who voluntarily exiting the market. While he thinks it could improve availability ever so slightly, commercial renters are highly efficient and have thousands more points than the average member, so it won't be very effective. While most DVC members will likely still be able to rent out to friends and family without issues, others may find the new language narrowly defined and worry about breaking the rules, Penny Cuff said. Many members often need to rent or sell their points if they can't take a trip that year. Otherwise, they lose money. If you've got 2 to 3 years in a row that life hits you and you can't go on vacation, your dues are still due every year, he said. Reputable third-party companies that specialize in booking DVC stays shouldn't be impacted by the update. Now to the sports section of today's Arizona Republic. Big headline on the beginning of this section, All-Star snub stings Thomas's teammates. Phoenix Sabali will start All-Star game. Satu Sabali has been enjoying early success with the Phoenix Mercury, helping lead the team to the second-best record, 12-5, in the WNBA, along with being named an All-Star starter. However, she was baffled by the absence of her teammate, Alyssa Thomas, on the 10-player roster that included Indiana Fever guard Caitlin Clark, Minnesota Lynx forward Nafisa Collier, and Las Vegas Aces forward Asia Wilson. She definitely should have been an All-Star starter, Sabali said Tuesday, July 1st. We're second in the league, and I feel like we've been underrated the whole time. For someone like AT not to be part of it, it just shows the system could be a little different. She'll be in there, and I trust in that because we all know what she can do. Thomas was sidelined for 5 games for a calf injury, but has been a major playmaker for the Mercury. Sabali credited Thomas for finding her at the right spots and opening the floor for her. Thomas leads all WNBA players in assists with a 9.3 per game, and is tied for the second most double-doubles this season with 7. The voting comprised WNBA fans, 50% of the vote, current WNBA players, 25% of the vote, and a media panel with 25% of the vote. It's super disappointing for AT, head coach Nate Tibbetts said. My guess is she didn't get the credit she deserves, but that's what happens when it becomes a popularity contest at times. Some people are deserving and some aren't. We're disappointed for AT, but super excited for Satu. Sabali played only 15 games last season with the Dallas Wings, but has been healthy this season and appeared in all 17 games for the Mercury. Sabali has to carry a bigger load as the Mercury have dealt with injuries, including Thomas and Kaylee Copper. Sabali leads the team with 19.1 points per game and 8 rebounds per game. She's 6th in the league in scoring and 7th in rebounds this season. When Thomas and Copper were idle, Sabali received help from a strong rookie group, including Monique Akoa-Makani, Lexi Held, Catherine Westbeld, and Kit Laksa. Laksa, 9.3 points per game, Held, 8.7, Akoa-Makani, 8.2, are the top 7 in scoring for WNBA rookies. I've been on teams where some want it and some say they want it, but don't really show it. So this is not the case here, Sabali said. Everyone comes into work, and that will show in the games. We don't give up and play all 40 minutes hard. That is the identity of the team. Even with the Mercury and Sabali clicking, Tibbetts believes Sabali is only scratching the surface of her abilities. Since Sabali joined the Mercury during free agency, Tibbetts was drawn to how much Sabali wanted to be coached and get better at her game. In her limited season last year, Sabali was the best catch-and-shoot three-point shooter in the WNBA and is slowly getting back to showcasing that as Copper and Thomas ease back into the rotation. Satou is so talented, and you're going to see her continue to get better, Tibbetts said. She's in great shape, and her habits have been unbelievable. She's continuing to get in here and work every day. I don't think she's shooting at the level she can. The names of the 12 All-Star reserves voted by the league's coaches will be unveiled July 6th at 9 a.m. Mountain Time. Head coaches will vote for three guards, five front court players, and four players at either position, regardless of conference. The head coaches for the AT&T WNBA All-Star Game will be the head coaches of the two teams with the best records through the games of July 4th, regardless of conference. The head coach with the best record as of that date will coach the team whose captain earned the most fan votes. Clark and Collier, the leading vote-getters, will draft the respective teams on July 8th. The All-Star Game takes place at the Indiana Fever's Gainbridge Fieldhouse on July 19th. And continuing with basketball, the Suns are keeping Gillespie to play point guard. The Phoenix Suns had a point guard issue since they traded Chris Paul during the 2023 offseason to acquire Bradley Beal from the Washington Wizards. Maybe Colin Gillespie is the answer, or at least can help fix the problem. The Suns have agreed to a one-year deal for the 2025-26 season with Gillespie. League sources confirmed it on Monday, June 30th, to the Arizona Republic. Gillespie turned 26 years old on June 25th. The 6'1 guard out of UConn played significant minutes late in the 2024-25 season as a two-way player for the Suns. He possesses similar qualities to TJ McConnell, who was instrumental in the Indiana Pacers reaching the NBA Finals this past season. The Suns also have landed European League champion and Final Four MVP Nigel Hayes-Davis. League sources confirmed with the Republic, the 6'8 forward had a brief NBA stint, playing a total of 9 games for 3 teams in 2017-18, but has become a star overseas. Gillespie averaged a career-high 5.9 points and 2.4 assists in his 33 games, shooting 43% overall and 43.3 from three in his first year in Phoenix. He raised those numbers in his 9 starts, 9.6 points on 47% shooting, 47.5% on threes, and 4.1 assists. Gillespie posted career highs in points, 22, assists, 10, and rebounds, 5, in 26 minutes of a March 28 loss at Minnesota. This was with Kevin Durant and Booker on the floor with him, as Gillespie only missed 2 shots from the field on 11 attempts, going 4 of 5 from distance. He not only showed the ability to make threes, but Gillespie also created his own shot and scored off the dribble. Out of 158 shot attempts, 88 were from three. He made 39. His second highest number of shots attempts came less than 8 feet from the basket at 41, made 18. Gillespie was a liability at times, largely due to his size. He has low assist totals, but Gillespie only committed 17 turnovers in 461 minutes played. A backup point guard who can start is what Gillespie can be for the Suns. McConnell has the same role in Indiana. He's a backup to an all-NBA point guard, Tyrese Halliburton, but the 6'1 veteran showed in his last 2 postseasons the ability to lead the offense and impact the game. McConnell averaged a career-high 11.8 points and 5.1 assists in the 2024 playoffs as Indiana reached the Eastern Conference Finals. This postseason, McConnell averaged 9.5 points, 4 assists, and wasn't a liability from three as he was a year earlier. McConnell shot 42.1% from distance, a big improvement from hitting a career playoff low, 26.9% of his threes in 2024. Beyond that, McConnell played with such competitiveness and fearlessness, he was just as much the talk of the playoffs as NBA MVP Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or Halliburton. Gillespie possesses the same qualities. The Suns could very well have their future starting point guard, but they aren't looking to rebuild either. The idea of Paul possibly returning to Phoenix feeds that narrative. NBA insider Chris Haynes reported Monday, June 30th, that the Los Angeles Clippers and Suns are options for Paul, who wants to play closer to his family in LA. Paul started all 82 games for San Antonio to become one of only three players to appear in 82 games at age 39, with John Stockton and Michael Jordan the other two. Paul, who turned 40 in May, averaged 8.8 points and 7.4 assists in 2024-25. The Suns have had more than their share of perimeter talent, starting with Booker, who essentially became the point guard last season and averaged a career-high 7.1 assists. They acquired shooting guard Jalen Green and wing Dylan Brooks in the Durant trade, which becomes official on Sunday. The Suns then landed wing Kobe Brea out of Kentucky in the second round of the 2025 draft. Phoenix still has Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, and Beal under contract. Beal seems the most likely of the three that the Suns could attempt to move or buy out, as he has a no-trade clause. The Suns attempted to share the ball-handling duties among Booker, Durant, and Beal, and seemingly everyone else in 23-24. That didn't work well enough, as Phoenix finished 25th in the league in turnovers that season at a 14.9 a game. The Suns were nearly as bad in the playoffs, committing 14.3 and getting swept in the first round by Minnesota Timberwolves that season. Phoenix thought it addressed the problem with signing Tyus Jones, one of the NBA's best ever at the assist-to-turnover ratio. That didn't work out either. Jones lost his starting job. Becoming more of a three-point shooter and playing off the ball, Jones averaged 10.2 points, shot a career-best 41.4% from distance for a second straight season, but managed just 5.3 assists, two fewer than the previous season with Washington, and a career-high 1.1 turnovers. ESPN's Shams Charania reported Monday that Jones has agreed to a one-year deal with the Orlando Magic for $7 million. He played a one-year $3 million contract in Phoenix. Booker took on the task of playmaker last season, still averaging 25.6 points, but he often played to how teams defended him rather than forcing the defense to adjust to him. After all, he's Phoenix's all-time leader in points. He's been collecting buckets for a living. The Suns could easily roll into this season with Booker continuing his role of facilitator with scoring ability, but maybe Gillespie can ease that load a little bit as his backup. And continuing with basketball, what Nigel Hayes-Davis will bring to Phoenix. Among the Phoenix Suns' latest roster additions, Nigel Hayes-Davis is the name that probably didn't ring many bells among fans. The NBA's free agency period opened on Monday, June 30th. Soon after, ESPN's Shams Charania first reported the Suns were going to sign the recent EuroLeague player to a guaranteed one-year contract. The Arizona Republic's Dwayne Rankin confirmed that report. Teams cannot sign players until Sunday, July 6th. Longtime college basketball fans who followed Wisconsin or the Big Ten Conference over the past decade might recall how Hayes-Davis made his mark before he turned pro in 2017. Most recently, he was thriving in Turkey as a champion and MVP overseas after a short stint in the NBA. Here's everything else you need to know about him. Position, height, and weight. He's a power forward, 6 feet 8 inches, 227 pounds. He's 30 years old. He was born in Westerville, Ohio. His college accolades and biggest NCAA moment, he played for Wisconsin, former 2016 All-Big Ten first-team selection. He led the Badgers to two straight Sweet 16 appearances in 2016 and 2017, including their defeat of then-defending champion Villanova, which included ex-Suns starter Mikal Bridges and his current Knicks teammates Josh Hart and All-Star Jalen Brunson, during the 2017 tournament's second round. His NBA experience and accolades? He joined the New York Knicks Summer League team in 2017 as an undrafted free agent following his senior season. In 2018, Davis played for the G League team, Westchester Knicks, and the Los Angeles Lakers, the Toronto Raptors, and their G League affiliate Raptors 905, and the Sacramento Kings. Was NBA G League All-Rookie Team in 2018. Davis has played overseas in the EuroLeague since then. In the EuroLeague, he played in Galatasaray Zalgiris, Football FC Barcelona, Fenerbahce from 2018 to 25, two-time Lithuanian Cup winner and champion 2020 and 2021, Spanish Cup winner 2022, All-Turkish League second team 2023, two-time Turkish Cup winner and champion 2024-25, Turkish Cup final MVP 2025, two-time All-EuroLeague first team 2024 and 25, and EuroLeague champion and Final Four MVP in 2025. His skills, he's tall, 3-and-D wing who's versatile along the perimeter and in the post. Offensively, Davis is a floor spacer as a deep shooter off screens, keeps defenses honest as a pick-and-pop threat, and roller to the basket. As a defender, Davis uses his length well, a little more than 7'3" wingspan, and solid timing as a disruptor in passing lanes for steals and deflections. Despite not having many years in the NBA, his international experience could translate well to the NBA, as the Suns need more height along with the wing and in the paint for rebounding and shots at the rim. They were 25th and 30th in those categories during last regular season. Davis hangs his hat on hustle. Continuing with sports and looking at baseball, the D-backs sneaked past West rival Giants on Monday. The score was Diamondbacks 4, Giants 2. On the surface, the decision was not a difficult one, not in Diamondbacks manager Torrey Lovello's eyes. His pitcher, Ryne Nelson, had taken a shutout into the seventh inning. The tying runs were on base, and Nelson's results had commanded and begun to waver, but Lovello said he knew, from a strict baseball perspective, what the best decision would be. "I'm not an idiot," Lovello said. "I wanted to leave him in the game as bad as everybody else wanted me to leave him in the game." But in a season filled with catastrophic injuries to the Diamondbacks pitching staff, Lovello said the decision to remove Nelson was about avoiding another one. The move immediately backfired. The bullpen wasted no time giving up the lead, but the Diamondbacks still managed to escape with a 4-2 win over the San Francisco Giants on Monday night, snapping a four-game losing streak. "I know I was the most unpopular man in the entire state of Arizona when I took out Ryne Nelson," Lovello said, "but he exceeded his pitch count. I ran him out there as far as I could." Geraldo Perdomo's single in the seventh brought home the go-ahead run. Eugenio Suarez added to the lead with a solo homer, his 26th of the year. An inning later, the Diamondbacks opened a key series against a division rival with a much-needed win, beating their ace, Logan Webb. But it was Nelson, charged with two earned runs in 6 2/3 innings, who was at the center of the night. For most of the six innings, Nelson was dominant, consistently pumping his mid-90s fastball past Giants hitters. It was his fifth start since moving into the rotation in place of the injured Corbin Burns. The Diamondbacks won four of them. But Lovello, whose pitching decisions have gone under the microscope given the struggles of the bullpen, was again scrutinized for a move. At a publicity event earlier in the day, Lovello said multiple fans presented him with managerial advice, suggesting he let his starters pitch deeper in the game. "I always say thank you, I appreciate that," Lovello said in his pregame session with reporters. And so it was no surprise when Lovello was greeted with boos when he emerged from the dugout with the hook in the seventh. Nelson had given up a pair of hard-hit balls earlier in the inning. He had started to fall behind in counts. But the consensus among Diamondback fans at Chase Field seemed to be that Lovello was making another mistake. Lovello seemed to understand the frustration, but he stuck behind his decision. Nelson had thrown a season-high 88 pitches. For most major league starters, that would not be perceived as dangerous territory. But Nelson has not been built up like most of the major league starters, and he apparently has been dealing with some kind of arm or body issue that has raised red flags with the organization. Like I keep telling you guys, I know what Ryne Nelson deals with, Lovello said. I know what he wakes up like tomorrow. We went above and beyond his pitch count. I just want to make sure that I keep Ryne healthy for the entire year. I was willing to sacrifice what happened, knowing there was a darn good chance it could happen. What happened was reliever Juan Murillo's first pitch was blasted into right center by Tyler Fitzgerald for a game-tying double on a ball that was nearly caught by a diving Alec Thomas in center field. For what it's worth, Nelson did not seem to have any issue with his manager's decision, though he did seem to want to didn't want to get into specifics regarding his health. "Yeah, I felt pretty good," he said, when asked if he could have gone one more batter. "I was still on a pitch count, though. I'm still kind of easing back into it. I think overall the body feels better in the later parts of the game than it has in the last few. It's a progress and moving in the right direction. Nelson opened the season as the club's long reliever. He threw between 31 and 54 pitches in his first six appearances since joining the rotation on June 7th. His pitch counts had ranged between 77 to 87 prior to this one. "No, there's a lot that goes into that," Nelson said. "It was a bit of a different start to the season than I'm sure a lot of starters have. I totally get it. It's people smarter than me making those calls." Asked what he's been dealing with physically, he said nothing in particular. "There's always some early season soreness, and I wore a line drive off the leg a week ago. If it's not one thing, it's something else." Despite the bullpen blowing its league-leading 17th save opportunity of the season, the Diamondbacks secured the victory. The game featured a controversial call in the eighth inning resulting from fan interference. The Diamondbacks' Tim Tawa tried to make a jumping catch at the wall, extending his glove just as a fan in the front row lunged for the ball. The ball cleared Tawa's glove and was caught by the fan just behind him. Initially ruled an out, the call was changed to a double after a review. It was an outcome that frustrated both teams. It was hard to tell if the ball might have cleared the wall for a homer, but it hurt the Giants most after their next two hitters, Rafael Devers and Elliot Ramos, struck out to end the inning, leaving the runner at second. Lovello said Alan Campbell, the club's video coordinator, was confident the ball would not have left the park, but Lovello felt fortunate the umpires ultimately agreed. "We dodged a little bit of a bullet," Lovello said. "It's a game of inches. We lost a game the other day on a tag at third base. Something a quarter of an inch quicker, we get out and we win a game against the Marlins. That's why it's such a beautiful game." First baseman Josh Naylor is out of the Diamondbacks lineup for the third consecutive game and fourth of the past six. Manager Torey Lovello said Naylor's neck and right side have started to relax, but it isn't to the point where he's able to return to action. "It's not perfect yet," Lovello said. "He took some swings. He's going to continue to work on it with an eye on being available at some point during the day today. He's working hard. He wants to get in there and play as soon as possible." This will be the third consecutive game Naylor has missed due to neck discomfort. Right fielder Corbin Carroll, who is out with a fracture in his left wrist, is planning to swing the bat on Tuesday, July 1st for the first time since landing on the injured list last week. Lovello said Carroll is still aiming to return sometime before the All-Star break with the hope of being available to play in the All-Star game if he makes the team. In other injury news, Lovello said right-hander Kendall Graveman will throw a bullpen session on July 1st and could face hitters in a live session later in the week. Lovello also left the door open a crack for right-hander Christian Mena to return before the end of the season, though he did not make it sound likely. "I think there's a small chance," Lovello said. "He's got to check some boxes first." And we'll turn to some hockey in the sports section today. Marner on Maple Leafs exit. He says, "Leaving isn't easy." Mitch Marner issued an emotional farewell to Toronto on Tuesday, the same day his hometown Maple Leafs officially confirmed he had been traded to the Vegas Golden Knights. "Leaving isn't easy. This is the city where I grew up, where I fell in love with hockey, and where I've had the incredible honor of living out my childhood dream," he wrote in an Instagram post. "Wearing the maple leaf on my chest wasn't just about playing for a team. It was about representing my home." The Maple Leafs acquired forward Nicholas Roy in exchange for Marner, who signed an 8-year, $96 million contract with Toronto as part of the trade before heading to Vegas. Marner, 28, was seen as the number one player in the upcoming unrestricted free agent class. He has spent his entire 9-year NHL career in Toronto, which selected him fourth overall in the 2015 draft. He said he leaves Toronto with unfulfilled goals. "When I was drafted, all I wanted was to help bring a Stanley Cup to Toronto," he said. "That was always the goal, and I came up short. I know how much this team means to this city, and I know the expectations that came with wearing this jersey. I gave everything I had, but in the end, it wasn't enough. That's hard to admit, because I wanted it so badly for all of us." He has career totals of 221 goals and 520 assists, 741 points, in 657 games, and is coming off a career year that saw him total personal bests of 75 assists and 102 points in 81 games. The 28-year-old Roy had 15 goals and 16 assists in 71 games last season. Over the course of his 8-year career with the Carolina Hurricanes and Golden Knights, he has accrued 68 goals and 98 assists in 369 games. The Leafs also confirmed the re-signing of fellow forward Matthew Nyes on Tuesday. They kept Nyes from entering free agency by signing him to a 6-year contract extension worth $46.5 million. Nyes, 22, was due to become a restricted free agent on Tuesday. The new deal has an average annual value of $7.75 million. He played 2 full seasons with Toronto, posting career highs in 2024 and 25 with 58 points, 29 goals, 29 assists, 152 shots on goal, 41 blocks, and 182 in 78 regular season games. And the Florida Panthers have won back-to-back Stanley Cup titles and have been to the Final Three 3 years in a row. If that doesn't say start of a dynasty, General Manager Bill Zito's recent magic might have positioned the team for another run and more. Zito had expressed confidence he could sell his 3 key pending unrestricted free agents on a winning culture and get Sam Bennett, Aaron Ekblad, and Brad Marchand re-signed. Playoff MVP Bennett was first, agreeing to an 8-year, $64 million extension that was announced before the draft. Then the team announced an 8-year deal for top pairing defenseman and 2014 number one overall pick Ekblad, worth a reported $6.1 million a year on June 30th. And reports emerged later in the day that Marchand, who scored 10 playoff goals after arriving in a trade, would be getting a 6-year deal worth a little more than $5 million a year. His contract will run until he's 43. Zito found that the team would spend the salary cap, and it will. And all 3 are taking under-market contracts to stick around. Also important, they aren't joining the Panthers' rivals. The Panthers now have Alexander Barkov, Matthew Tkachuk, Sam Reinhart, Bennett, Carter, Verghaeghe, Marchand, Anton Lundell, Seth Jones, Ekblad, and Gustav Forsling signed through at least 2030. Zito also made a recent trade for goaltender Daniel Tarasov, 26, who will get to learn under veteran Sergei Bobrovsky and possibly be the Panthers' number one goalie of the future. The Panthers are like a family. Witness how Captain Barkov made sure that all the first-time Stanley Cup winners got to lift the cup before last year's winners did. That camaraderie is a key selling point. So is winning. And the Panthers have put themselves in a position to do more. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Turning now to the opinions and columns section of today's Arizona Republic, we'll start with the first opinion. It's by Elvia Diaz, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Tortoise shop deserves heat over MAGA hat post. What happens when a tortoise shop becomes ground zero for a political explosion? It costs them business. In a deeply divided America, where a post can trigger a boycott and a hat can start a firestorm, Tortoise Manantial, a restaurant with multiple locations serving Metro Phoenix for more than two decades, found itself walking straight into the fire. And it all started with a post showcasing the red hat. Yes, that one. The Make America Great Again hat. Carla Barbosa, daughter of the restaurant's owner and the public face of the business, proudly posted a photo of herself wearing the MAGA hat on social media. But it wasn't just the hat. It was the tone, the defiance, the unapologetic snub of those who are against Trump's hardline policies. Many are mad, but trust the process, Carla posted. America will be great again. It wouldn't be such a big deal if it wasn't for the fact that the Tortoise Shop customers are mostly Hispanic, many of whom are certainly fearing deportation under Trump. The reaction? Fast and furious. And the backlash hasn't simmered down. It's still boiling. And customers who turned away apparently aren't coming back anytime soon. The owner, Marco Antonio Barbosa, posted a video on social media reassuring customers that he and his wife are immigrants themselves and would never hurt the community. But he never mentioned his daughter and Trump and never acknowledged the post. Essentially, he never apologized. That was just a desperate attempt to get customers back. Is it too little, too late? Many on social media certainly think so and have gone out of their way to leave bad reviews everywhere they can. I've left repeated messages for Marco Antonio, but he didn't return them. Carla, meanwhile, has made her social media private. No statement, no walking back anything. This isn't just a story about a restaurant. It's a cautionary tale. Because in 2025, if you're a Hispanic-owned business, politics isn't something you can ignore. It's the air you breathe, the fire you dodge, and the storm you try to survive. And for Tortas Manantial, that storm, by many accounts, is still hitting them hard. That was written by Elvia Diaz. She's editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. You can reach her at elvia.diaz, D-I-A-Z, at arizonarepublic.com. Opinion is by Joanna Allhands, columnist for the Arizona Republic. There's a lot to dislike about Arizona's universal school voucher program. Lawmakers intentionally left the checkbook wide open on parents' expenses, for example, leading to maddening stories about taxpayers footing the bill for golf simulators, luxury watches, and collector Lego sets. This, even as Arizona ranks near the bottom nationally for per pupil spending and teacher pay in its public schools. But how do we stop it? Editorial page editor Elva Diaz asked me that question in a recent video discussion of the program. And that's the thing. We don't. Not right now, at least. I agree that vouchers need more accountability, and not just for the $1 billion that is expected to be spent on them this coming year. We know woefully little about the roughly 86,000 kids who are receiving the cash. Case in point, I spent a half hour searching for how many of those kids attended private school or learned at home. I still don't know. We know even less about what they're learning. And that makes it impossible to determine what we really are getting for our investment, other than, of course, golf simulators, Lego sets, and at least a portion of private school tuition. There have been calls since the beginning to just roll the program back to its original intent, which was to help kids with special needs get specialized services. Governor Katie Hobbs has proposed regular audits and income caps on those who can receive state cash. But the Republicans who control the legislature have no intent of doing any of that. A citizen-led initiative to peel back the expansion never made it to the ballot. And that doesn't leave much wiggle room for changes, at least immediately. It's important to understand why there is such a visceral reaction to the program, though. Because it's not just about vouchers. At its base are arguments about fairness and of school choice and how changing expectations since the pandemic are also weighing down on education. All of which, sooner or later, we'll need to address if we truly want to improve the quality of education in Arizona. The legislature argued 3 years ago that universal school vouchers would be the ultimate in school choice. Families would be free to pursue whatever education option best suits their kids. But vouchers haven't leveled the playing field. They've just added additional complexities to a funding system that was created when nearly everyone attended the district school down the street. Those days are long gone. Even before universal vouchers, nearly half of the public school students in Maricopa County weren't attending their assigned district school. Meanwhile, long-term demographic changes have begun wreaking havoc on public schools, all of which have giant buildings to fill. They were built big on purpose when enrollment was surging, because that was the most cost-effective way to handle so many new students. Except now, people are having fewer kids, and high housing costs make it difficult for families to live in a lot of those once fast-growing districts, which is why so many are now talking about closing schools and laying off teachers. And while the pandemic didn't change what makes a good school, you still need highly motivated teachers and a dynamic leader. Our expectations for schools have changed. Parents want a lot more flexibility in the school day and year. They want lessons to not be so one-size-fits-all. And there's been a general malaise since the pandemic because most schools don't meet those expectations. I suspect that's why there are such visceral reactions to vouchers and such an outcry about how we're shortchanging public schools, even as many vote with their feet. Love choice. We just don't pay for it like we do. That was written by Joanna Allhands. You can reach her at Joanna, Joanna, dot Allhands, Allhands, at ArizonaRepublic.com. And the next column is from E.J. Montini, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Alligator Alcatraz is Arizona's tent city on crack. President Donald Trump and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem flew to Florida on July 1st to help Governor Ron DeSantis and others open Alligator Alcatraz, a concentration camp for immigrants in the middle of the Everglades. It was a move right out of the playbook of former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who rose to national prominence in Arizona for his own personal outdoor gulag, Tent City. The sheriff, now in his 90s, has noticed, posting a long take on X that reads in part, "Over the years, the Tent City Jail saved taxpayers millions of dollars and became an international phenomenon and success story, even drawing presidents, presidential candidates, celebrities, news media, and the public from around the world." The international phenomenon part is true. Arpaio was first elected in 1992, and every Republican presidential candidate after that traveled to Arizona to kiss his ring. Arpaio said outrageous things, made outrageous claims, staged outrageous stunts, just about none of which had anything to do with law enforcement, and he was still reelected. He was an Obama birther. He made wild accusations about other politicians. What Arpaio doesn't talk about much is that he cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, Maricopa County supervisors just authorized a $34 million payoff for abuses carried against migrants by Arpaio's deputies, part of a tab that is expected to reach $352 million by mid-summer 2026. In 2016, Arpaio was among the first to endorse Trump. In 2017, when Arpaio was facing possible jail time for criminal contempt of court, Trump pardoned him. It was the first pardon Trump issued. Alligator Alcatraz is getting a crazy amount of national and international attention, just as Tent City did. It's a boon for the Republican Party campaign coffers, just as Tent City was. Republicans are even beginning to sell Alligator Alcatraz merchandise. Anyone out there still have a pair of Tent City's pink underwear that Arpaio sold by the thousands? I wrote in 2015, when Trump first announced his plans to run for president, that, quote, "he can get elected because Arizonans already have elected Donald Trump many times." I was talking about Arpaio. It's a fairly simple political calculation. Arizona invented Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio invented Trump. That was written by E.J. Montini. You can reach him at ed.montini, M-O-N-T-I-N-I, at ArizonaRepublic.com. And the last editorial, lawmakers know Medicaid cuts will hurt children in Arizona. Guest columnist Robert L. Meyer is the author of this. Lawmakers have claimed that the federal budget bill, which the U.S. Senate narrowly approved on July 1st, will not impact Medicaid coverage for children. Unfortunately, that simply isn't true. The touted savings cannot be achieved without directly affecting coverage and care for Arizona's kids, especially the most vulnerable among them. Medicaid is the foundation of pediatric care in our state. Nationally, 50% of all children are covered by Medicaid. In Arizona, that number is 40%. At Phoenix Children's, approximately 65% of the families we serve depend on Medicaid coverage. Arizona's Medicaid program, known as ACCESS, provides vital care for children battling cancer, living with disabilities, or recovering from organ transplants. It also ensures access to preventative services, such as immunizations and wellness visits, giving children the chance to grow up healthy and thrive. The cuts threaten to dismantle this critical support system. That includes changes to the state's provider tax, a cornerstone of Arizona's Medicaid financing strategy. The provider assessment helps fund Medicaid without putting additional pressure on the state's general fund, allowing Arizona to invest in other vital services like education, transportation, and public safety. Phoenix Children's is both a contributor to and a beneficiary of this system, using these funds to ensure high-quality care is available to every child, no matter their background. Slashing Medicaid doesn't just harm children. It threatens our state economy. Healthcare drives growth across industries such as construction, manufacturing, and hospitality. The ripple effects of cuts to Medicaid funding are substantial. Every $1 billion cut in federal Medicaid funding is projected to cost Arizona 36,000 jobs and $3.7 billion in economic activity. These numbers tell a clear story. Medicaid is not just a health program. It's an economic engine and a safeguard for Arizona's children. Any attempt to cut it under the guise of fiscal responsibility will have long-term consequences for families, healthcare providers, and our state's economy. I urge lawmakers to protect Medicaid and reject proposals that jeopardize the well-being of our children and the strength of our communities. The future of Arizona depends on it. And this was written by Robert L. Meyer. He's president and CEO of Phoenix Children's Hospital. You can reach him at rmeyer@phoenix-childrens.com. And time now for the horoscopes. If you're an Aries, afraid you'll lose approval, appeasing a partner compromises more than your comfort under Libra's first quarter moon. For Taurus, spiraling over that awkward coworker interaction, we'd recommend not overthinking it, but that's impossible during the Libra first quarter moon. For Gemini, feeling romantic, blame the Libra first quarter moon. Cancer, emotional confrontations. During the Libra first quarter moon, you struggle to assert yourself. For Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, psychic interference, tune it out. Listening to popular opinion undermines your intuition under the Libra first quarter moon. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, analysis paralysis. Your future happiness hangs in the balance under the Libra first quarter moon. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, questioning your direction. The first quarter moon falls in your sign today. For Scorpio, rethinking your stance during the first quarter moon in Libra, changing your mind brings up all the feels. For Sagittarius, suddenly hesitant? Under the first quarter moon in Libra, be wary of asking the wrong people for life advice. Capricorn, an early afternoon blunder sparks conflict with a partner under the first quarter Libra moon. For Aquarius, is your attention beginning to drift? Distraction will peak in the early afternoon. And finally for Pisces, what are they thinking and how can you use it to your advantage? The Libra first quarter moon has you scheming. Time now to turn to Dear Abby. First letter, Dear Abby, after years of disappointment, I finally found the man of my dreams. How do I tell him he isn't doing certain things right in the bedroom without it being uncomfortable? I've mentioned it before, but it didn't stick. This is the only problem with our relationship. I don't want to hurt his feelings or make either one of us uncomfortable, but he's not getting the job done. Signed, Working It Out in Tennessee. Dear Working, I will assume that the man of your dreams loves you and wants to take care of you. Although this may be a difficult topic to address, communication is very important. Ask your doctor or gynecologist for a referral to a licensed sex therapist, then tell the man you love you would love him to accompany you. If he loves you, he will go and learn something. If his ego gets in the way, have a conversation about what you need at a time when you're both calm and relaxed. And communication is easier, not in the bedroom. And dear Abby, I moved away from my hometown 10 years ago, and I have a dear friend of nearly 30 years who still likes to sleep next to me when she visits. This is becoming so annoying that I don't want her to visit. It was fine when we were younger, but we're in our 40s, and I no longer want to sleep next to anyone. I don't like pajamas. I like to sleep cool and in the dark, while she is always cold and likes to sleep with the TV on. My friend won't tell me what her problem is. She says she's not scared to sleep alone. She has a husband at home, but she nearly freaked out when he went on a weekend trip with his friends. I have a very nice guest room, but she never wants to sleep in there. She does not respect my boundaries, and I don't want to sleep alone. And that I want to sleep alone. Can you help? Signed, Solo Sleeping Lady in Maryland. Dear Solo, I sure can. The next time this friend wants to visit, grow a backbone. Tell her you no longer want to share your bed with her or anyone, and if she can't be comfortable in your guest room, she should stay home. Gee whiz. And dear Abby, the next letter. Today I asked a man with a black mole on the side of his face if he had been checked for skin cancer, because I come from a family with a great deal of skin cancer. The man was very patronizing and told me I should just go sit down. My husband previously ignored my concerns, but he did listen to a friend who was concerned that his dark mole could be precancerous, which it was. Was I wrong for bringing this to a stranger's attention? Signed, Proactive in California. If you said it in the context of explaining that your husband had something similar that turned out to be cancerous, I don't think what you did was wrong. It may well have been presumptuous, but it was also well-intentioned. He may have reacted the way he did because it made him feel self-conscious. You can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com. And we have time for a couple of comics here. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood's walking in the door after work, and Blondie's at the door, and he says, "Boy, what a day." And she said, "Oh my, bad day at work, honey?" He says, "Actually, it was a fantastic day. And that's the problem." She says, "How so?" And he said, "It reminded me of how bad all the other days are." Zitz, Jeremy and his friend are practicing for their band. Jeremy's sitting on a chair with his electric guitar, and he's holding a little piece of paper with the lyrics. And the other guy's just listening, and he starts reading the lyrics. He says, and the lyrics go like this. Majestic shelter, enchanting abode, a symphony of elegance, envelop me in your splendor. And his friend's eyes get big and says, whoa, profound, dude. Jeremy says, yeah, I copied them off a real estate ad. And in Baby Blues, Daryl says to Wanda, Hammy wants us to have a family team mascot. And Wanda says, yeah, I heard. And Daryl says, what team name would actually fit us? And she says, the McPherson Veggie Haters? And Daryl says, you're not taking this seriously. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mutig, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona.